1 Samuel again, and chapter 17. Days of warring, David as a soldier. 1 Samuel 17, verse 4, there went out a champion of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span. He had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and so on. Now you know so well the story there. Look down at verse number 23, and it says there, and he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spake according to the same words, and David heard them. Verse number 34, and David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear. And he took a lamb out of the flock, and I went out after him, and smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he rose against me, I caught him by the beard, and smote him, and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine, shall he be as one of them? Shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. In verse 40, Saul has tried to array him in his armor, but David puts them off him, and he took, in verse 40, his staff, and chose him 5 stones out of the brook, and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a scrip, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine, and so on. Look at chapter 18. Now, I would wish we would have time to read this entire chapter. Just, we'll have to break in verse number 5. And David went out whithersoever Saul sent him, and behaved himself wisely. Look down the chapter. Verse 8, and Saul was wroth and was displeased, and saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me but thousands. What can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. Verse 12, Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with him and was departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from him, made him captive over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways. And the Lord was with him. Wherefore Saul, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. And all Israel and Judah loved David, because he went out and came in before them. Then there is the plot that Saul has for David to give him Merib, his wife, and eventually Michal. Now, if you'll just look down the chapter, and verse number 30, the princes of the Philistines went forth. It came to pass after they went forth that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was much set by. Turn to 2 Samuel in chapter 5. Verse 17, when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines came up to seek David. And David heard of it, he went down to the hold. And the Philistines also came and spread themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them into my hand? And the Lord said unto David, go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into thine hand. And David came to Baal Perazim, and David smote him there, and said, the Lord hath broken forth upon mine enemies before me as the breach of waters. Therefore he called the name of that place Baal Perazim. And they left their images, their idols, and David and his men burned them. Then the Philistines come again, and David inquires in verse 23, thou shalt not go up, but fetch a compass that behind them, and come up over them against the mulberry trees, verse 25. And David did so, as the Lord had commanded, and smote the Philistines from Geba until thou come to Gezer. Turn to chapter number 8, verse number 1. Came to pass after that David smote the Philistines. Verse 2, he smote Moab. Verse 3, he smote also Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah. Verse 5, when the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David slew of the Syrians 22,000, and so on. And look at verse number 11, speaking of the wealth, which also King David did dedicate unto the Lord with the silver and the gold he had dedicated of all the nations which he had subdued. And here's a list of them, of Syria, of Moab, of the children of Ammon, of the Philistines, of Amalek, of the spoil of Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah. And the end of verse 14 says, the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. One final reading, chapter 21, verse number 15. Believe it or not, they're here again, the Philistines. They never let up. The Philistines had yet war again with Israel, and David went down and his servants, and so on. Verse 16, Ishbibenob, which was of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight, he being girded with a new sword, thought to have slain David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, succored him, and smote the Philistine, and killed him. Verse 18, after this, there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob, where Sibekah, the Hushathites slew Saph, who was of the sons of the giants. And there was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines when Elmanah, the son of Jerorogam, a Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was yet a battle in Gath, a man of great stature, had on every hand 6 fingers and every foot 6 toes, 4 and 20. He also was born to the giants. When he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, the brother of David, slew him. These 4 were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. God will bless the reading of his word. David the warrior. Amazing that David never lost a battle. The closest you come is what we read in chapter 21, when as an older man, having passed the prime of life, he was almost slain by one of the giants, but he was succored and he was slain by one of David's soldiers, and David was not injured. But David was a successful warrior, a successful soldier in the field of battle, and was never defeated, and he fought for God. But I want to talk to you about the enemies that he encountered and the behavior he exhibited, the victories or the triumphs he enjoyed, and the tactics he employed. Now, we want to make this practical. It has to do with the fact that you and I both are in a daily battle. We've spoken already about sin and failure and recovery. Here then is the trial that we go through, the temptation, the lure, the battle we fight each day in dealing with the issues of sin in your life and mine. So I want you to think first of all of the treachery of the foe. Of the treachery of the foe. They come in different sizes, don't they? There were giants that he had to face, as well as normal men and women. There were giants, though, who seemed insurmountable. Things that he wondered, how will we ever get past that? And maybe there are giants in your life that you wonder, how will I ever overcome this sin, this temptation, this trial? Giants. There was size. There was speed. We didn't read it. We read it in the last reading. The Amalekites, with lightning speed, came in while David was away. Before David knew it, they had come in. They had spoiled the city, taken captive all that belonged to David. And there are sins that come upon us with incredible speed and rapidity as we move through life. A glance at a billboard, something we hear, something we see. And sin suddenly confronts us in our pathway with tremendous speed before ever we realize we are being faced with tremendous trial. But also there was stubbornness. Enemies that don't go away. Do you notice? The Philistines. Relentless. They never gave up. Defeated, they came back. Defeated, they came back. Defeated, they came back. They never cried uncle. They never rolled over and played dead. They were always relentlessly, stubbornly confronting David and the people of God. And there are sins that with tremendous stubbornness continue to plague and to confront you and me. So their size, their speed, their stubbornness, there's the strength and the skill of the Moabites and the Assyrians as well. Hired soldiers, men who were mercenaries. Their skill was in battle. Their strength was in battle. And there are things that seem temptations and things that seem so strong. And they are. We're no match for them. And then there was that which was savage in its approach, the lion and the bear. All of those were some of the treachery of the foe that David had to face. I want you to think as well, though, of the timing of the foe, of the timing of the attacks. As a youth, David faced the lion and the bear. It was in his early days that he faced the giant, just the stripling of a lad. There were the major battles of his youth. A giant and a lion, and a bear. David faced them in youth and overcame them. As a young man, it was the fury of Saul, as Saul sought his life, and Saul sought to follow him and pursue him and take his life. As a king, it was the onslaught of the enemies of God, but even more so, it was rebellion in his own home, a son who rebelled against him. And as an old man, lo and behold, giants again. I thought we got rid of them when we were young. I thought the giants were done when I was a youth. No, giants again as an old man. You know what I learned from that? I learned that there are certain sins which never, never go away. When Paul was writing to Timothy, he said to Timothy, "Flee youthful lusts." Now, on your first reading of that, your impression, as mine is that there are certain lusts which are unique to youth. But that's not what it means. It means the lusts are always youthful. They never grow old. It's always there. When you reach 60, the flame doesn't go away. When you reach 70, although I'm not there yet, but I think I'm going to be right, it doesn't go away then either. Lusts are youthful. And I'm not just speaking in the moral realm. We link lust with just one thing. But there can be lust for power. There can be lust for pride. There can be lust for place. There can be lust for possessions. They don't go away. You may have overcome them as a youth, but they're back again in old age. And it reminds us that there are things that we will be confronting throughout our lives. So set it in your mind now. Today's victory is going to be faced by opposition again tomorrow, by fresh trial, by fresh challenge, if you will, in the same spheres. And we live our lives one day at a time with the help of God. So we have the timing of the foe, but you'll notice the tactics of the foe. They vary. How the enemy attacks varies depending upon the enemy. Some came openly and defiantly like the giants. You know, an in-your-face kind of temptation that came labeled as temptation, came labeled as a challenge. There was no mistaking it. It came openly and defiantly. But then as well, there was that which came deceitfully behind David's back. There was a son named Absalom. And he is manipulating to get position and to get leverage in the kingdom. And David hardly has any idea that this is going on behind his back until finally it's too late. So sin can come in deceptive guise. It can come appearing to be something very innocent and very, very innocuous. So could I just raise a note of caution? Could I just draw your attention, especially young people, to what you read, to what you watch, to what you listen to? There may be some value to some of those things, but we should never forget. There is behind all of the media industry, and I know you may think this sounds paranoid, but there is behind all of the media industry a master schemer. You understand that, don't you? When Paul is writing to the Ephesians and he speaks about Satan, he speaks about the wiles of the devil. That means the carefully planned strategy. So you realize that there is a strategy going on that Satan has masterminded to control the thinking of men. I mean, if you were going to change behavior, if you were going to change values, if you were going to make people forget about God, how would you do it? I mean, you would begin to change their thinking. Have them think that right was wrong and wrong was right, and that this life is the only thing, and that sensual pleasure is really all that matters, and self is the only important person. You would begin to manipulate the minds of men to think that way. Well, he's done it. Done it very successfully. You know how he's done it? He hasn't opened up people's brains and put a little chip in that's made them think a different way. He's done it through the media. And everything that people read, everything people watch, entertainment, it is all with this whole philosophy in mind that you are the most important person. Self-satisfaction is all that matters. This life is all that matters. And what you have and experience is all that matters. And eternity, God, spiritual values, we left that all behind when Queen Victoria died. Okay? And he has skillfully, masterfully controlled the thinking of an entire generation. So when you pop that DVD in, and when you all gather around and instead of speaking, talking together about scriptural things, decide to watch a movie, just remember, what values are you buying into? Well, you may say, we can tell the good from the bad. Really? You really can? You really can ferret out the good from the bad and the bad isn't? Really? That just shows how far you've already bought into it. That shows you've already bought into it if you think you can watch all of that and somehow be immune from... Now, I'm not saying that you should never watch a DVD. I'm not saying you should never listen to music. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying you need care. You need tremendous care as to what you are listening to and what you are watching, what you are reading, because if it is a product of the mainstream media, it is designed with this in mind to control the minds of men. Make no mistake. The game is to control your mind, to manipulate your thinking, to either buy what they want you to buy, think what they want you to think, go where they want you to go, And you can brazenly sit back and say, I am stronger than that. Well, you just take a word of warning. You're already sucked in if you think that. And so, challenge to you as a Christian, temptation to sin can come, not just openly and defiantly, but deceitfully, surreptitiously, just guised in the cloak of innocence. It can come as well, it came as well in David's absence. When David was away, they came to Ziklag and took everything, and it can come as well, amassed in tremendous might and power, when in chapter 10, the Ammonites see themselves as being despised in David's eyes, and they gather a vast army together and come to seek to fight with tremendous power. So there are different tactics that are displayed. What is it we can learn from these foes? What is the teaching from these foes? Well, the first thing I learned is this, that sin is persistent. It never gives up. At every stage of life, at every step of our Christian life, we are confronted by temptation to sin. And the thing is, when we think we've arrived that we're not there, that's the very time when we are there the most. So you'll just recognize, won't you, the need to just honestly own before God, I am weak, I am dependent, and I face temptation every day. And if God does not preserve me in my steps, I could very easily fall. So the first thing I learned, that sin is persistent. It never, never gives up through life. Sin as well is powerful. Naturally speaking, every foe that David faced should have overcome him. He was outnumbered. He was outsized. He was out-soldiered. Every enemy that David faced should, naturally speaking, have overcome him. So do I need to tell you that in your own strength, in your own determination, you cannot overcome sin. Can't be done. Sin is persistent. Sin is powerful. Sin is pervasive. Wherever David turned, there were enemies. We looked at that in the very first meeting. Wherever David turned, there were enemies to be faced. And not only that, but he found them within as well as without. There were enemies at every hand. To the west, the Philistines. To the north, the Syrians. To the south, the Amalekites and the Moabites and the Ammonites. All around him in a circle. Enemies on every hand. Challenges to be faced everywhere. So at work, at school, in your home, even in the assembly, there are things that will arise that may well give you this confrontation of sin. So the enemy is persistent. The enemy is powerful. The enemy is pervasive. The other problem is the enemy is always present. Because, was it Pogo who said, we have met the enemy and it is us? Okay? You know the biggest enemy you have? You. So my biggest enemy is me. So my biggest problem I have is me. Because I can go into my home and I can shut the door of my home, and for the most part, I can shut the world out. I know the computers are there, and I know telephones are there, and beepers, and so, you know, yeah, I know all that. But what I'm saying is, for the most part, you can go into your home and shut the world out. You have that choice anyway. And I don't think Satan, in fact, I know Satan, is not omnipresent. So he is not bothering me most of the time. In fact, it's probably very rare that Satan directly attacks any believer, because he just can't be everywhere at the same time. He has constructed a world that does all that he needs it to do for us to cause us to sin. So the need for personal attacks upon believers is not that common. So Satan is not there to bother me all the time. I can shut the world out, but I can never get away from myself. Remember reading, I think it was in National Geographic, it was about the ill-fated attempt to climb Everest when that group from Texas and the other group both went up and misjudged some things, and so many professional climbers lost their lives in that tragedy back a few years ago. Someone asked one of the expert climbers, why is it that people try to climb Mount Everest? What is it that is challenging them? And they say, well, there's many reasons, but sometimes people want to get away from themselves. He said, the only problem with that is, he says, wherever you go, there you are. You get what he's saying. Wherever you go, there you are. You just can't get away from you. You can't get away from your flesh. It's always there. In your holiest of moments, it suddenly intrudes. In your best of moments, it suddenly rises. And just when you think you've got things under control, it pops up again with tremendous sobering reality. The enemy is always present. We looked at the behavior that David exhibited in chapter 18 of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 18 is a tremendous chapter. Many, many lines of truth that can be taken from it. It's interesting. I'll just leave this in passing. You can look at it for yourself. It is the chapter in the Old Testament with the greatest number of mentions of love other than Psalm 119. The word love is mentioned more often in 1 Samuel 18 than it is in any other chapter of your Old Testament except for Psalm 119. That tells me something about relationships and the respect that David was gaining with his people and what it was based upon. And I'll just have to leave that. You can look at that for yourself. But you will see in that chapter the increasing challenges that David is facing. There is envy by Saul. There is manipulation. There's entrapment. There's hostility. David is facing all of those challenges from the enemy, his enemy Saul, in 1 Samuel 18. What about the conduct he displayed? We read it. I think you noticed that he behaved himself wisely, behaved himself very wisely, behaved himself more wisely. He seems to be growing in wisdom as he's walking like a cat on a fence, trying to guide his steps as Saul is plotting time and again to entrap him and to see him taken down in battle. And so, time and again in that chapter, he has seen behaving himself wisely as he walks amidst so many different temptations and trials. Where are you and I going to find the wisdom to walk in a world full of things that would entrap us and snare us and defile us? Wisdom for your walk. Paul writes of that, doesn't he? Walking wisely. Walking in all wisdom. Paul writes of it elsewhere as well, of the will of God, even your sanctification, holiness and life. Where are you and I going to find that kind of wisdom for day-by-day challenges? Finding it in this book, aren't you? It's the only place you can find it. The only place you can come to know how should I behave in these circumstances? How should I behave when at school they're telling their stories around the lunch table? How should I behave when I'm confronted with an offer? Why don't you go here? Why don't you come with us and do that? Where are you going to find that kind of wisdom? In the Word of God. He behaved himself wisely. And again, we didn't read it. He was, the commendation he received, he was accepted, he was loved. His name was much set by. He seems to be growing as he faces different trials and different temptations. He's growing in his acceptance and in his fellowship with God. Because that was really the key. That was really one of the keys for his wise walk. We didn't take time to read each and every instance that it's mentioned. Verses 12, verse 14, verse 28. The Lord was with him. The Lord was with him. He was with the Lord. What was he doing? He was cultivating fellowship with God. Cultivating fellowship with God amidst hostile conditions. I mentioned, I think it was this morning, if not it was early this afternoon. Need just to mention it again. Not old-fashioned. Not legalism, not rules and regulations. When you have been told by older brethren and older sisters, spend time with God alone each day, try to do it in the morning if you can before you go out to face all the opposition of the world. But if that's difficult, get something from God in the morning and then spend more time in the evening. You need it. You'll have to have a relationship with the Lord that is real and genuine and vibrant. If you are going to be able to live with all that is out there and all that is in here and not succumb to sin in all of its many forms. So there was a cultivation of fellowship with God and there was a cultivation of the fruitfulness of God. He displayed Christ-like character in all of his movements in that chapter. Again, time doesn't permit, but if you look at it, he was marked by humility. He was marked by meekness. Saul actually tried to get him angry, and David meekly accepts the changes Saul made relative to his wife. He is marked by wisdom. There is in David a wealth of fruit that is being seen in that chapter that helps him to walk through a hostile scene without succumbing and without somehow being drawn in by all of the traps that Saul was laying for him that he might bring David down. And so keep in mind then the need for fellowship with God as you move through life. Victories that were enjoyed by David in his battles, I just can only mention them. There were giants that were smitten. Any giants in your life that you would long to have removed? It is possible. David was marked by overcoming giants. Now you can apply them if you like to apply them. You've got a giant with six fingers and six toes. And certainly that would remind us of covetousness. And you've got a giant, and it mentions about his bedstead being 9 cubits. That's a giant called laziness. Nobody here has that problem, do they? You're all up 5 a.m, chanting your Gregorian chants and, reading the Psalter and all, aren't you, at 5 a.m? No, I know. But no one here who just lays in bed lazily and wastes time like that. Big bed, 9 cubits long, plenty of room to sleep. And there was a giant as well with the weaver's beam, materialism. Now, you can run with those and do what you want with them. But the thing is this, David knew what it was to overcome giants. And there are some tremendous giants out there that if you are going to live for God, you will have to overcome. Tremendous obstacles in the pathway for God. There is a world that will offer you tremendous material gain. Now, there's nothing wrong with material wealth. Nothing wrong with it, if God gives it. There's everything wrong with it if that's what you go in for as your priority in life. You will go in for it at the loss of your spiritual usefulness. There is nothing wrong with recreation. We all need some diversion from the routines and the demands of life. But if you become obsessed with recreation, that's the most important thing in life. If you become obsessed with materialism, all of these giants that the world goes after, then they will block the pathway of usefulness for God. There were giants that were smitten. There were idols that were smashed. We read of that in 2 Samuel chapter 5. The Philistines left their idols and David smashed their idols. There are lots of idols that need to be smashed. Men sat before Ezekiel one day, pretending to want to hear the voice of God in their captivity. And God said to Ezekiel, these men have idols in their hearts. They weren't bowing down to idols literally, but they had idols in their hearts. Things that were more important to them than God and God's honor. A lot of idols we have to smash. Little children, keep yourselves from idols was the aged John's final word to his children. We all have idols. The idol of acceptance. Don't think that's an idol? An idol is something you sacrifice to get something back from. You ever sacrifice something for acceptance? Let me talk about myself. Ever keep my mouth shut, fail to testify, so that I would be accepted by the group? Well, you say, is that an idol? Yeah, that's an idol called acceptance. The idol of popularity. The idol of attainments. And the 21st century is seeing another idol called the idol of appearance. How I look. Forever young. Well, I lost that a long time ago, the hope of even that, so that's gone. But, the idol that our culture worships at of being forever young. And so, whether it takes Botox or plastic surgery, whatever it takes, forever young in appearance, and worshiping my own body, my own physique, my own muscular appearance. You think these things are insignificant? They're real. They are things that trip up many. These are idols that need to be smashed. David could smash Philistine idols. As well, there were enemies that were spoiled. David could spoil the enemy and use the treasures of that for God. There were oppressors that were subdued. There were obstacles that were stormed. There were accusers that were silenced. There were foes that were rendered strengthless. Go through the whole list of how David dealt with his foes and see the triumphs that David knew in his life for God. But I want to come to the tactics especially because most young Christians say, all that's fine. All that is nice theory, and what you say is true. We do face sin. We do face temptation. There's something in me that sometimes responds. How do you overcome? How do you get the mastery over this thing called indwelling sin and the flesh? It's nice for you all to talk about it and preach about it and tell us all of these wonderful truths. How do you do it? I don't understand it. I still seem hopeless. And so someone says, well, you're dead, and sin no longer appeals to you, and all you need to do is go to school the next day, and man, it sure can still appeal to me sometimes. I got to fight it. It appeals to me strongly. And so you realize, I'm not really dead to the appeal of sin. So how do you overcome? Let me come then to the tactics that David employed in his victories. The first thing is an attitude that David had. An attitude that David had. You know what the first one was? There was no hypocrisy. When he went out to face the giant called Goliath, he told Saul, I'd be a hypocrite going like this. Saul, that's not what God has provided me. So no hypocrisy. Listen, don't be a hypocrite when it comes to this thing. Don't lead two lives. Don't lead a hidden secret life of feeding on sin and try to be an outward, good-appearing Christian when you're with the saints. You can only live a double life so long before you finally collapse. Don't be a hypocrite. Be real. In this matter of the battle that you and I are in relative to sin, you better be real, because if you're not real, you're going to fall. David was no hypocrite. But not only that, not only was there no hypocrisy, there was no complacency. No complacency in David's life. You notice, maybe I should have read it and stressed it when I read it. You notice in 2 Samuel chapter 5, he went out to fight the Philistines. And he asked God, should he go up against the Philistines or not? And the Lord gave him instruction to go up with the promise that he would deliver the Philistines into his hand. And so we read there how that David went up and defeated the Philistines. And then the Philistines come again. And David said, same thing, same time, same day, same way. No, God says, not that way this time. This time the way for victory is to go around by the mulberry trees, and when you hear the sound of the goings in the trees, then you attack. You know, we can begin to think that because we've overcome sin once, tomorrow will be no difficulty. We'll just overcome it again. David was never marked by complacency. He was just as ready to call upon God when he had an entire army behind him as when he faced the Philistines as a poor fugitive with only 400 soldiers. You would have said, David, you've got the entire nation behind you now. You certainly don't need to call upon God for help. Now, wait a minute, no complacency. Yesterday's victories do not guarantee tomorrow's victories. So never become complacent. Never begin to feel as though you have arrived or I have arrived and we have overcome and now this will no longer bother us and no longer appeal to us. Yes, thank God, the same sins don't always appeal to us in the same way at the same time. There are times when, as a result of enjoying something from God and something of God, sin has very little appeal to us. Other times where it screams at us as though our name is written all over it. So David was marked by no hypocrisy. He was marked by no complacency. He was marked by no self-sufficiency. He never felt he was sufficient in himself to face the foe and overcome the foe. There was no self-sufficiency in David. You'll have to learn that lesson as every believer has learned it. It is a painful lesson to learn. It is extremely painful to have to bow and confess, I am absolutely helpless in myself. If God doesn't strengthen and preserve me, I can't face it. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not responsible. I am responsible. But I am responsible to recognize my helplessness and to cling to God and to depend upon His strength, not my own. There are things we need to flee from, just as Joseph fled. Just as Paul tells Timothy to flee. Things we cannot face. Things we cannot handle. Things we need to flee and not to face. But then there are things that we need to face day by day. So let me talk then not just about an attitude, but about an arsenal. An arsenal. What do we have to deal with? What did David have, maybe would be a better way to put it. We're reminded, aren't we, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but are mighty through God. So our resources are in God and not in ourselves. So just think with me of some of the resources that David had and see if we can find lessons in them. There was a stone from the brook, wasn't there? A stone from the brook. There was a sword from the sheath. There was as well a staff he had in his hand. There was skills from the mountainside. And there was strength he had from the Lord. So, stones from the brook, a sword from the sheath, a staff in his hand, skills he learned upon the mountainside, and strength that he was imbued with from God. Now, we wouldn't think of most of those as being very great weapons. A sling and a stone, a staff, a sword might possibly be viewed as being significant. Skills he learned as a shepherd upon the mountainside to fight armies. And finally, the strength he claimed he had received from the Lord. That was what David had in his struggle and in his battles. David was safer with a sling and stone than he was with the sword of Goliath. When David had the sword of Goliath on his side, he almost lost his life down in Gath. When he faced the giant with just a little, I was going to say measly, just a little stone and a sling, he was far safer. So What are the weapons then God has given us? Well, I don't know how you want to spiritualize things. I don't think that's the key thing. The key thing is this. There was an enemy that had to be slain at a distance. That's the sling and the stone. But then there are enemies that have to be slain pretty close. That's the sword. And David realized there are enemies I need to face at a distance. There are enemies I have to confront face to face. So there are enemies that you have to keep at a distance and defeat at a distance. You can't get near them. Don't even try to get close to it. Keep it as far away as you can. And there are foes that are going to confront you face to face that you'll need the sword to be able to slay them close up. That's really the word that is used in Ephesians chapter 6, the sword of the Spirit, the small fighting sword for close in combat. Because at times the foe is right on your neck. It's breathing down hard upon you, and there's no room for a sling and stone, but the sword is what you need to be faced with. There was as well the staff in his hand that reminds us of this great truth. Here was a man who was marked by dependence. He wasn't walking in his own strength. So before you go out in the morning, if you don't have time for anything else, then you bow your knee and you tell God how dependent you are upon Him for the day, to be preserved from all the temptation, all the evil, all that will confront you, and all that will draw you in. Skills he learned upon the mountainside were experiences he had with God alone when he learned God alone in secret. What you learn of God in secret, what you learn of what God is like in secret, will enable you to stand against the temptations that you will face as you deal day by day in the world. Let me just mention one thing, though, about this final point, the strength of the Lord. I puzzled over this for a long time as a young believer, and it's a great help to me to know that every place it is used in the New Testament, it is not me strengthening myself in the Lord. I thought that's what you just said. No. It's allow the Lord to strengthen you. He does the strengthening. It's His strength poured into me. So it's not what do I do to somehow be strong in the Lord. It is rather what I allow God to do in me. I allow His strength to control me. Now, still you may say, this all sounds pretty theoretical. So let me bring it down to every day if I can. And let me use an illustration that perhaps, maybe you've heard me use this before. I've struggled to get a better one, and maybe I'll come up with a better one someday. But still, this answers the issue. You know, you read in Romans chapter 6 that, we have died with Christ and we've risen with Him. And, that we're dead unto sin. We should live unto God. And I just don't find that working out in my own experience. So please explain it. Well, I think you have to understand what Paul is saying and where Paul is coming from. You've been taught, and I've been taught, and we still teach, and rightly so, that Romans is the courtroom drama. And it's the picture of a courtroom and a judge and all that goes with it, and it continues to be in chapter 6. So let me bring you to a courtroom. Probably now, somewhere in the range of 70 years ago, I had grandparents who, having come to this country from Italy, stood before a judge in a courtroom. And they took an oath of allegiance to the United States government, and the judge pronounced them to be citizens of the United States of America. They had come from a foreign country, from Italy, and had emigrated, and as a result of their desires, they became American citizens. The moment the judge said, "You are now citizens of the USA," however he said it, that moment they had a choice to make. Would they avail themselves of all the privileges of being Americans, or would they continue to think of themselves as citizens of Italy? Well, obviously, if they've gone through all of this, they wanted to think of themselves as citizens of America. And they wanted to begin to enjoy some of the benefits of that, and some of the freedom that it brought them, and some of the rights and liberties that were theirs now, because they were citizens. But what had changed? What had made the difference 5 minutes before the oath, and 5 minutes after the oath? What made the difference was the oath. They were declared to be this. They were now declared to be citizens, and they now had a choice. Before that, they had no choice. Before that, their only choice was they were still citizens of Italy, living on foreign soil. Having taken the oath, they now had a choice. Being citizens of America, they could choose to live that way, or they could go back to the old life. Now, bring that to what Paul says in Romans chapter 6. He says, first of all, knowing. Knowing that what occurred when Christ died was the end of all you were in the flesh. All that you were as a creature of Adam ended. Our old man was crucified with Christ. So the first thing is, you know something. Hey, the judge has said, as far as my standing in Adam, it's dead. He says, now reckon yourselves. So now he says, begin to think of yourselves as those who are alive from the dead. Because of your union with Christ, you now have a new life, a life that comes from Christ. Reckon yourselves to be alive unto God. And now he says also, in light of that, yield your members to God. You've been brought into a new life. Yes, you could choose, although it's morally inconsistent, you could choose to go back to the old life, but you have another option open to you now. You no longer have to sin. You have a new option open to you. Because of Christ, because of the life you have in Christ, the freedom, the liberty into which you have been brought, you've got a choice. You can choose to live as a Christian, or you can choose to live the way you were before you were saved. You can choose to live as an American, or you can choose to live as someone who still is an Italian, living on foreign soil. Choice is yours. And so when confronted with sin, before you had no choice, now you have a choice. And he says, yield your members. And then he says one other thing, not only knowing, not only reckoning, not only yielding, but he says obeying. Obeying. And so when the word of God is brought to bear upon your circumstances, you obey. When you're confronted with temptation, and the word of God addresses that temptation, when the Spirit of God brings to your mind truth, you yield yourself to God and you obey it. And so there's nothing mystical. There's something marvelous about it, but there's nothing mystical about what Paul is writing in Romans chapter 6. He is just telling us that you now have a choice. You now have resources that enable you to overcome the flesh. And those resources are found not in yourself. They're not found because something has changed about you. Those grandparents were the same people before the oath as after the oath. It was just they had a whole new standing. A whole new standing before the law. They now were seen as American citizens. And all its liberties, all of its freedoms, all of its potential, all of its resources, all of its laws, all of its legal system, everything was at their disposal. That's what you have now that you're a Christian. All the resources of God are at your disposal. His Word, His indwelling Spirit, the advocacy of Christ, the high priestly work of Christ, it's all at your disposal. All to enable you day by day to face the reality of challenges and temptation to sin, and yet to overcome and to know something of victory, just as David did in his own life. So there is an awareness then. First of all, I belong to the Lord. There is a life that I now have. I'm a new creation in Christ. Yes, the old could still appeal to me if I let myself go that way. But my new life in Christ, as I feed it, as I nurture it, as I nourish it, it grows and I begin to enjoy spiritual things, divine things. There is a law that is given to us here, that to whom you yield yourself servants to obey, his servants you are to whom you obey. But there is the liberty that God gives, being able now to obey the word of God. That's what Christian liberty is. Some people think Christian liberty means the right to do things that other people think are wrong. You know, Christian liberty means I can drink, I can smoke, I can go to whatever I want to go to and do whatever I want to do to, because that's Christian liberty. Christian liberty is the ability to do the will of God. When you were ungodly in your unsaved state, you could not obey the will of God. When you were saved, you were brought into the sphere of liberty, and that liberty is the ability to obey the will of God. That's what Christian liberty is. And God has brought us into a sphere of liberty now where we can obey His word, obey His will, and bring Him honor and bring Him glory. So may the Lord help us in these hurried comments to see in David's life as a soldier and his overcoming principles and teaching that will help us as well as believers, moving without a sense of hypocrisy, without any complacency, without any self-sufficiency, in total dependence upon God, moving in the sphere of a new life and a new liberty into which He has brought us, to move so as to honor and please God.